Okay, now let's move on to our next interviews. And I don't need that anymore. We now have in the studio Chris Luskery and Bill Masoulas, who are here to talk about the next round of Australian independent films in Unknown Pleasures. Welcome again to the studio, Movie Metropolis.
Thank you, Peter.
Hello, Peter. How are you?
Very good, very good. I'm just making sure all the levels are right, and I think we're okay. Now,
I'm feeling you guys are regulars here.
Yeah, Chris is. Chris,
I was here once before, and the journey up to Werribee was beautiful.
Right, yes, subtext galore in that statement. Got it. Now, let's talk about curating this series of films, which starts on the 6th of May.
Yep.
Okay, let's. How did you find the films and what?
They're all in our heads. They're all in our memories. And yeah, there's a million kind of independent / experimental / underground films around in Melbourne and other cities of Australia. And it's just a matter of kind of choosing which ones we feel, warrant a little bit of exposure at the moment. And especially if the filmmaker's around, we like to have Q&A discussions at the end of each screening. And yeah, we just kind of feel that a lot of this stuff is not being recognised at the moment, and we're very happy to put these films on, even if it's sunny at a small venue.
We kind of worked out this sort of really organic, very natural way of splitting up the curatorial duties, where Bill tends to be focused predominantly on the more contemporary underground Australian films, whereas I take a more split retrospective focus, somewhat provocatively, because a lot of the films that we program that are retrospective titles could sort of be construed as, if not mainstream Australian films in their original context, i.e. What I have written, the John Hughes film, but certainly a little bit more known within the specific socio-historical context that they were created in than they are now. So they've kind of, through the journey of their life post release, they kind of have become a little bit underground or a little bit unknown as a result. So in that sense, it's a bit of a kind of a, I guess, a positive provocation from us to try and put those works into that context.
And just also to remind people that 20, 25, 30 years ago, films like What I Have Written and other ones like Bedeviled by Tracy Moffat and Refracting Glasses by David Perry, which is one of the titles we've got coming up.
And Aya by Soren Haas.
Aya by Soren Haas. So these kind of films were, at the time, fully funded by the AFC, you know, $1 million, $2 million. These days, these kind of films would not get anywhere in terms of funding. So,
I look at the great tragedy of a filmmaker like Clara Law, for instance, like someone who really, with Floating Life in 96, was like radically ahead of her time in terms of creating narratives about Australian Asian diasporic experience, and that kind of experience fed through into subsequent work, and then just stopped at a certain point because there was no impetus behind the funding bodies keeping. I mean, I don't know the particular story in Clara's case, but certainly in relation to what we now see is like issues of diversity in cinema. We kind of have those filmmakers already. We've just forgotten about them, I think, a little bit. And so it's, in the case of programming like Minority Voices or the work of female filmmakers, for instance, which is something we both are very focused on doing, it's also about paying respect to the people that have pioneered those spaces in the past. I'm very, very focused on like migrant filmmaking, for instance, because one of my personal family connections was the Italian-Australian filmmaker Giorgio Mangiamelle, who pioneered sort of a kind of lyrical realist style in Australian cinema and basically created the first kind of what could be construed as European art film in 1964 with Clay. And again, like just another voice that became increasingly marginalised. So I think that the idea of underground has not just definitions to do with particular funding streams, funding models or availability of resources, but also political and diversity ramifications as well. Okay. And formal ramifications, because a lot of these works are quite daring or quite innovative in their forms as well.
Okay. Yeah. We should mention all of these films, and we'll go through them, playing at Long Play at 318 St George's Road, North Fitzroy. And the website is pureshitozcinema.com.
Yep, I love that name. I love saying it. I love hearing it.
Well, I still remember.
People should know, it's a classic film from 1975 by Burt Dealing called Pure Shit. It was called Pure S at the time.
It was.
In the liberated 70s, but we're a bit maybe a bit more liberated now. Now it's called Pure Shit.
Exactly. So celebrate that on the website. All right, now let's start with May 6th with Anna Canova's film Kissing Paris, which I remember seeing such a long time ago. Fascinating film.
Mm. You've seen it. Did you see it at the awards?
At it was at the AFI, yes. Yeah, because I go back many years with the AFI awards.
Yeah, MIF, Melbourne International Film Festival, who I do love, but I will say that they rejected this film. And it's a really wonderful film. So Anna Canava was someone who, as a young woman of 20, was at Rusden Film School, and she then kind of went into making a few documentaries, and she ended up making two feature films, Dreams for Life in 2004 and Kissing Paris in 2008. And then she actually died young, or at the age of 50, in 2011. And she, as Chris was saying a moment ago, she's a migrant filmmaker. She's from Cyprus, and when the Cyprus Turkish invasion happened in 1974, her family came to Australia. She was about 14 at the time, and she assimilated, and look, she's just a wonderful filmmaker. So this film is made on a very low budget of $20,000, which the Australian Film Commission at the time, in the mid-2000s, had a fund called Strand X.
Mm.
And with Strand X, you could actually get $20,000 to make a narrative feature. And you weren't accountable. You didn't have to pay full wages and all this kind of thing. And she chose to make this feature in Paris. So she and her lead actress, only the two of them, went to Paris. $20,000, you can imagine half of it is going on the plane fares and the accommodation and this kind of thing. Yeah, definitely. And so they went and made this film, and it's a really interesting film because it plays with the notion of you know, Paris as the city of romance, and but it's got this incredible kind of sadness and melancholy in it, and then it kind of just tries to thematically go through like all of life, not just kind of love, but what it means to be alive. And And so this screening is on this Monday, which is in 2 days' time, and the lead actress, Natalie Vella, will be there, and she will talk about the film. And, yeah, Anna Canava is a much-loved figure for a number of us, and the Artist Film Workshop had a retrospective of her work just last year, about 6 or 8 months ago, that Chris was involved in, and that was a great screening.
Okay. Great. Now, May 9th, I'm not familiar with Chris Windmill, but you've got a number of short films.
Okay, Chris Windmill, this is another one that I've curated, so Chris can talk about the ones he's curated.
Yeah.
Chris Windmill was a filmmaker making Super 8 films in the 1980s, pretty much, and into the 90s, and also films on 16mm. He went to... In fact, did he go to Rusden, or he certainly went to Swinburne, you know, Swinburne Film and TV School in the early 80s. And, he just made a lot of Super 8 films, and so this is a collection of about 10 of his short films. He never has made a feature. Maybe he still will one day, but he seems to be inactive at the moment for the last 10, 15 years, apart from a few little kind of videos he's been putting together. And he'll be there discussing his work. And his films are really interesting. They're kind of comedies, but they're very wry, and they're very subtle, and they examine the everyday. And he appears in them along with his partner. And Chris, have you seen many of
his
films?
I've never seen any of Chris Windmill's films. No, never, yeah.
So this series we're curating is really interesting because each of us curates something, and then the other curator has not seen it, and they can get to see these films as well. So
and even in some cases, I'll program stuff specifically because I haven't seen it. It's like a form of pedagogy and self teaching, really. I definitely think that there's such a diversity of scope to the kinds of work that Bill and I are collectively interested in, but they're definitely seems to be some common threads. Like, we're very much interested in formally innovative work, we're interested in sort of more politically radical or exploratory work, we're interested in kind of the essay mode of filmmaking or films that blend sort of documentary and fiction practices, we're interested in low budget filmmaking or DIY filmmaking. So there's a lot of different kind of points of intersection between the films as well, just made in different kind of periods.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
interesting. Yeah. Now Soren Huas,
yes,
Aya, I remember fondly that film, Aya, and I'm glad that you're screening it.
Thank you. Aya is a film that is very, again, similar to Clara's films, albeit a little earlier than Floating Life, emerges from a really particular context, and I think for many years Soren was a real, I guess, kind of admirer of Japanese culture and had spent a lot of time in Japan and had made a number of documentaries in Japan. Aya is her only feature film treatment of that material and her only traditional length feature film in total. And it's really interesting. It's actually, I think, a really underrated film. Just in terms of the depth of examination it gives to the kind of cultural clash between the white characters and the Japanese character, but told very much from Aya's perspective, yep, which is incredibly rare, especially as a migrant European woman filmmaker herself, to be able to project that sense of cultural identification, but also to keep a certain barrier. So there are moments in the film that feel kind of lifted quite directly from Ozu, but the film is also like a sort of a covert, somewhat repressed melodrama, and I think it works beautifully in between those two modes. It's also very beautifully shot.
Yes,
yeah,
absolutely. I remember the images were superb. Now, that's on June 13th. Now, June 24th, the film that you're screening, I remember talking to Donna McRae, I can't remember how many years ago, about her film Johnny Ghost, and it was such a really intriguing, personal sort of film, and I'm glad that you're screening it.
Yeah, see, Donna's work is really interesting. I met Donna 3 years ago, I reckon, when I almost applied to the Deakin Film School for a project, and I just remember she was really incredibly warm, and that subsequently had told me that she'd made a film, a feature film called Johnny Ghost, which I saw at the time, and then subsequently she went off and made Lost Gully Road, which got her the DGA nomination recently, which I thought was really well deserved. She makes these really kind of minimalist, very atmospheric ghost stories, in the tradition of Jacques Tourneur, almost very, very kind of interior, there's all these kind of subterranean levels of kind of meaning and subtext. Like in Johnny Ghost, there's quite an important thread of the story that connects to the Melbourne punk scene of the 80s and the kind of emotional, spiritual refuse that sort of came out of the destruction of that scene, as the kind of underbelly of the ghost narrative that happens. And so, obviously that feels totally appropriate to a kind of underground film aesthetic, but it's also very interesting because it merges directly out of Donna's experience at that time, which would be really interesting to talk to her about.
Yes.
It's also a very short film. I think it's only 71 or 72 minutes.
Yes, I remember it wasn't a very long film.
It's quite beautiful and quite formal. And
yes.
I think will be a really good experience for viewers.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. I mean, it's so important that so many of these films are screened because they sort of maybe have one or two screenings, maybe at an AFI screening or whatever.
Yeah.
And then have been lost in the shuffle. So that's June 24th. July 16th, now, again, I'm not familiar with Refracting Glasses by David Perry.
Yeah, as I said earlier...
This is one I haven't seen.
Ah.
Yeah.
Ah, okay. Yeah. Well, I have seen it, but my memory's always very poor, so I won't say too much about it. But David Perry is like a seminal figure. You know, he was part of the Ubu group in Sydney in the late 60s, a group of experimental filmmakers who... So along with Albie Toms and a few others, he was part of this group, and they were great. They were having, you know, happenings and you know screenings where they were presenting these really provocative kind of experimental / collage kind of films, and a lot of their lives, they themselves are in the films. David Perry made a short film called a sketch on Abigail's belly, which is like his wife at the time, his partner, you know, is kind of nude in a bathtub, and we kind of, I think we see a little animation or something happen on her belly. So, you know, that was sort of semi-banned, as was another film called Boobs a Lot by Aggie Reed. So anyway, David Perry is a seminal figure of the experimental scene. And so, you know, you flash forward to 25 years later in the early 90s, and all of a sudden the AFC is giving him $1 million to make a fiction film that's really more like an essay film, you know, very political, you know, quite radical, and... so you haven't actually seen it yet.
I've never seen
your program.
I programmed it because I really want to see. I basically went through all that period of time, basically where Peter Sainsbury was at the AFI looking at
AFC.
Setting up the and managing what was the second iteration of the Experimental Film Fund, and looking at all those films from I guess 85 to 92, 93, maybe a bit later. And just seeing what an incredible run of films they were, even when they weren't particularly successful commercially at the time. There's various films like Broken Highway by Laurie McGuinness, which I don't think has been screened very much.
No.
But Perry was definitely, perhaps, I think in that mix, the most notable of the kind of experimental filmmakers of the 70s that got to make a film of that scale. And
Albie Toms also, of course, from the Ubu Group, made Palm Beach in 1979-80 and a couple of other features. And so he's probably more known of a figure than David Perry in a way.
Yeah.
I guess we should also mention that, firstly, going back a couple of screenings, Solren Hoas is not alive anymore.
No.
And David Perry the same. So unfortunately, we can't invite him to speak about their films. But we didn't want to let that stop us. You know, we really value having discussions with filmmakers, but of course, you know, we still want to screen these films. So.
And we do have guests coming for both of those screenings as well, which have we announced yet? I think we will announce probably in the coming weeks who they'll be.
Okay.
But we're very, very glad to have the support of the filmmaking community in helping us co-present these screenings. And also, very important, we should mention that... our co-sponsors on the David Perry screening and on the Solren Hoas screening are Art Films, Christa Dolge's Art Films / Contemporary Arts Media Company, who have basically given us the permission to screen Refracting Glasses, and also Ronin Films. Andrew Pike gave us Aya, just out of the goodness of their hearts, which was really good.
Excellent. And there's one more film to mention on July 22nd, which I've seen. And I can't remember the context of Throbbin 84. It's so over the top. It was. I was waiting for some subtlety. It didn't happen. Timothy Spanos's film.
Look, Tim is a really interesting figure. He's now made 8 feature films at a kind of indie level, and this is actually the first one I've seen of his. I saw some of his early short films, and he's really interested in. TV culture of the 80s and you know, this kind of pop culture especially this film, it's like a satire pastiche of 80s kind of films. And look, he has a lot of fun with it, and
high camp is a subtle way of putting it.
It's very well made, it's very well scripted, and he's got like one of the lead roles, and you can see him, he delights in saying these crazy lines, really crazy lines. And what alerted me actually to Tim Spanos a little bit in more recent years was Jake Wilson of The Age being interested in him and talking about him. So actually Jake's going to be there on the night doing the Q&A, leading the discussion.
Okay.
And what can I say? He's someone a bit different, Tim. And we're happy to program him.
It's good to have a mix of films that are also really, really funny.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, yes, yes. No, you've got a really interesting array of films starting on Monday, going through to July 22nd, and that's at Long Play. So it's a $5 admission charge.
Yep.
Yep. 318 St George's Road, North Fitzroy, and as we've mentioned, Pure Shit Oz Cinema, auscinema.com.
Yep.
Yes, on community radio we can say lots of things. but that's a really good website to visit. And of course I should alert you to two potential other films that you may want to consider later down the track.
What are you here promoting, you guys? Yeah.
Well, Siobhan's film. Well, Siobhan and Andrew both have really interesting films.
Okay.
Well, I think my title might appeal to you. It's called You Can Say Vagina. So if it's on the pure, you know, there you go.
Excellent.
And I'm on your website.
Yeah, I know so about you, Andrew.
Yeah,
a bit,
so
yeah.
I'm here talking about Crime and Punishment, but we met Peter at at the Indonesian Film Festival recently.
Yeah, right.
So kind of, we both teach at the VCA as well.
Oh, okay.
So we're
kind of
cross-pollinating tonight.
Yeah, excellent. Where is your film showing? Is it showing somewhere? Or?
No, not at the moment. It's just, you know, in the festivals. So it's had, you know, festival screenings.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, great.
And it's really worth seeing. It's, And the other film that Andrew made, The Independent, might be one that you might
I haven't seen any of Andrew's work yet, so I must catch up with it at some point. So, yeah.
Please do. Happy to screen anywhere you'd like it to screen. Feel free.
Ditto.
Yeah, sure.
Well, when we finish up in about 10 minutes, you can perhaps... share information or share
clandestinely exchange discs.
I think it's we'll actually exchange
or streaming
links.
Files, yes.
Links, yeah. so it all happens on Movie Metropolis. That's where you really get to know filmmakers. And so
like speed dating.
speed film dating. Yes, I like it. I like it. Mm. So now that I've got all of you in the studio, I like to ask these overarching questions. Australia does have a rich history of films, independent films,
yes,
to some extent commercial films.
Mm-hmm.
Where are we going in terms of our filmmaking and our potential in terms of audiences seeing Australian films?
What, any kind of films?
Any kind of films, but in particular the ones that are perhaps more off the beaten track.
I don't know, we're probably going around in circles. There's cycles of these things. In terms of appreciation of art cinema, and then that can happen for a while, and then more commercial cinema kind of comes to the fore again. I don't know, Chris?
I just came back from seeing Avengers Endgame, and my experience of it was that the apocalypse is upon us in some respects, even though, I mean, it's a perfectly well-made film, but I guess what I mean by that is that the split between the different kinds of cinemas has grown, and I think so. The mainstream is consolidating and becoming even more like that, even more, I guess, like endlessly self-recycling.
Yeah.
And then the more niche stuff, which I guess could even include the Lee Chang Dong film Burning, even though 5 years ago that's a film that would have played for 6 to 8 weeks, might now only play for 4 or 5.
Mm.
You know, that's considered a kind of off mainstream film, even though it's a very good, very commercial thriller, in my opinion.
Yes.
But that's the level where things are at. Like, if you're not playing in the Palace, or even to some degree the Nova, you're kind of not even considered part of the kind of like independent cinema, art cinema ecology. You're just completely put on a rung underneath that, and then there's a further rung underneath that. And I think in terms of how that's going to affect filmmaking, that's tricky. I think more people are continuing to make films, and I think even more people will continue making films. I think the challenge, certainly always, but maybe even more particularly since the advent of streaming, is distribution and filmmakers getting some kind of cultural and commercial return on their investment, crudely put, in filmmaking. I think that's becoming harder and harder and harder. But it's conversely easier and easier to make a film.
It is. And of course, Siobhan and Andrew have graduates each year who are going into a market which may or may not be accessible for many of the graduates in terms of having their film screened, be it also on digital platforms, streaming, Netflix, all that sort of thing. So I don't know, where are we heading?
Mm. Gee. I feel exhausted just thinking about it. It's, you know, depressing.
I think we're pretty safe. I think there's more and more people are making films. I think it is more difficult these days to achieve some kind of commercial distribution. It's mm-hmm. interesting. The first film I made, The Independent, which was 2008, I think it was released. We were one of Australia's first self-distributed digitally distributed films.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Where we came up against a wall was, it was interesting that when we literally just got on the phone and rang cinemas and said, we've got this film, would you like to play it?
Mm.
And we got it into about 35 cinemas throughout Australia.
Yeah, wow,
but
great.
It was amazing. But to a T, they said, love to screen it. We've got one screen that's digital. We've got mm-hmm. four screens that aren't digital. We need a 35mm trailer for every one of those other screens.
Yeah. Wow.
So there goes all our money for it. But interestingly...
Did you make the trailer?
We did.
Yeah,
we did
great.
It, and we did it, yeah. But everyone said, wow, good on you, you made a film. Let's screen it. Now that wouldn't happen. That's the difference now. Like mm. you ring it, you can't really ring a cinema and just say, well, you can. You can pay for a screening and yeah. things like that. But then it was. And this was only 10 years ago. It was quite an amazing thing that you had an independent film mm. and the distributors, sorry, the cinema owners could slot it in between the Avengers and mm. things like that.
Yeah.
But now that's much tougher. Mm. Much tougher.
Have so you looked into cinema on demand much? Because there's actually it's only something I've recently started researching, but I think last year there was earlier this year, really amazing documentary called Island of the Hungry Ghosts by Gabriel Brady mm. that has sort of done reasonably well on the kind of cinema on demand circuit to augment its festival and limited sort of theatrical release. And I wonder if it's the way distribution is going, it's much more of a kind of augmented model rather than just a single, you know, you make a film and then, you know, approach a distributor and or a sales agent and get the film released in cinemas that way. Mm-hmm. It seems like it's more atomized and there's more components that go into distribution now. So like a split model that might include event-based screenings with Q&As and live performance elements and then a one-screen release at a major capital city and then event-based screenings to time with other festivals. And do you sort of feel that, yeah. that's a viable model for the people that you're teaching?
I think it's a viable model. Mm. I don't think it's a viable model to recoup the budget of a properly made film. But
indeed,
it's,
yeah.
But, you know, that's the beauty of filmmaking these days, especially independent filmmaking, is that the budgets can be quite low and you can write towards a budget and you can get yourself a camera and all those kind of mm. things. When I think about it now, actually, it's really... Distribution is not the problem because you can put a film up on Ozflix or you can put a film on a platform. It's letting people know that it is on that platform.
Mm.
So the marketing of the film
mm.
is always going to be the large problem. But social media helps that. You know, the Crime and Punishment has 5,500 followers on... That's the film that mm. last film I made. Has 5,500 followers on Facebook, which is amazing.
That's great, yeah.
That was just through the three producers continuously putting the word out there. So it can be done. It can be done. And that's the beauty of it, I think, is mm. it can be done. I mean, you know...
Yeah, listen, I'm terrible at all of that stuff. That's my problem.
Mm.
I can make the films, and that bit I really love, and I can make them for virtually no money, but getting them out into the world is the bit that I'm dreadful at. And I think, my big thing is I don't think we make enough cheap, lumpy, difficult films, and it's incredibly lovely to hear you talking about films that in some ways are probably cheap, lumpy, wonderful kind of films that are esoteric and odd and mad and kind of wonderful. Yeah. And I think that cultural space doesn't exist in a healthy way in Australia. And I think making lots of films that have huge problems but also huge, huge spaces of wonder in them is something that we don't do culturally. And I think that's a terrible shame. And all of these things about distribution and finding enough money and being funded and all those kind of spaces doesn't quite fit that either, you know, because it's about making art that is not to please. It's about making art to... have a conversation that's really complicated and fun and difficult and ugly with the world, and that bit we don't fund. Or we don't even notice, I think. Yeah. And I think that's the bit that I don't know how to fix, and I think we just need to be making an awful lot more and not always be worried if they don't work.
Mm.
Let's start the revolution.
In that space. Exactly.
Let's do it.
I'm with you.
I also think that the big thing that's happened with this democratisation of the technology is collaboration is... more, it's not like an auteur-driven market anymore as it used to be. There's a lot more things like web series, smaller platforms, people collaborating who wouldn't necessarily collaborate.
Mm.
Democratization has led to diversity in filmmaking, both in front of and behind the camera.
Definitely.
You know, you look at Netflix these days and, you know, subtitled films, no problem. Whereas 10 years ago, watching, you know, Channel 9 or any other screen, you'd never see a subtitled film. You'd have to go on SBS to do it, whereas now they buy it in its native language. So, look, I think it's there's a lot of positives for the whole industry in the accessibility.
Yep. And the bottom line is, of course, Australian audiences supporting Australian films and Australian stories, and that the government also does that. And let's hope with the election happening shortly that whatever the outcome...
I don't think there'll be a significant change to film financing policy.
I haven't heard many policy announcements on funding films.
I did hear that Screen Australia have run out of money at the moment.
For PEP, for PEP.
Right now, yeah. Sorry, the producers program, right now they've...
Oh.
Until the end of the financial year, which is, fingers crossed, not going to be for too much longer.
No.
All right. Well, we have to finish. We've reached the witching hour of 10 p.m. and it has been wonderful having in studio Bill Masoulas and Chris Luskrey talking about Unknown Pleasures, Australian films, and Siobhan Jackson and Andrew O'Keefe talking about their films and working at the VCA. It's been such a fascinating discussion. We should do something like this more often.
Yeah, it'd be great.
Thank you very much for having us.
Thank you so much, everyone. And so this is Peter Krause saying farewell for Movie Metropolis. I won't be in the next 2 weeks. I'll be in Tassie for BOFA, Breath of Fresh Air Film Festival, hosting lots of screenings and talking about the films that we selected over those 2 weekends.
Looks like a wonderful
Hobart
program.
Hobart and Launceston. It's a really good program, including Island of Hungry Ghosts, which you've mentioned, and so on. So... we'll see if anyone can be in the chair in the next week or two so I can ring in. But if not, I'll be back in 3 weeks' time. Peter Krause, Movie Metropolis. Goodbye.